Hello, and welcome to the thing which I have been most excited about for about the past year, which is Slate Money Extra, the Succession recap mini season of Monday morning Slate Money shows, where you have all, of course, stayed up watching Succession last night, because what else is there to do on a Sunday except for watching the greatest television show on TV right now? And we are going to just recap the entire episode and talk about what's going on with some of the most interesting people in media. I need to say this right up front. If you haven't seen episode one, don't listen to this show. Go and watch episode one. It's fabulous. And then you can listen to the show. All of these shows are going to be filled with spoilers for all of the episodes. So don't listen to this show unless and until you've watched the show. Now, I am, of course, Felix Salmon of Axios. I am joined by Emily Peck of the Huffington Post, who is also a Succession stan.
Hello.
And for this first episode of this little mini season, I cannot imagine anyone better to come on this show to join us than Ed Lee of the New York Times.
Ahoy, ahoy.
Ed, you have been covering all things media for decades.
Forever and ever.
Forever and ever.
Oh, my goodness.
I think Ed started somewhere in the 17th century. He knows everything about everything. And most importantly, you've been just as obsessed about this show as anyone.
I have been. I mean, I watched the first season as they aired, as they came out, and I, for the most part, liked it, but I definitely had some issues. I mean, when you cover an industry so in-depth for so long, you're like, that's kind of not right. That doesn't quite work.
Were you worried that some of it wasn't quite verisimilitudinous enough?
No, but that's the thing, is that I actually adore just how geeky it got about finance and media and corporate takeovers.
And like capital stacks.
Oh, absolutely. Like, this is kind of great. But then when you get it wrong, you're like, ah, why did you have to go do that now? Right? Like, it's almost better sometimes if they didn't quite go that deep. Because you're like, I mean, maybe I wouldn't be as interested, but that's...
But yeah, so the thing which I was obsessed by more than anything else is, like, who are these characters? Because everyone obviously sees Murdochs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there are two sons who are sort of like rivals. There's the daughter who's kind of out of it, but kind of not out of it.
There's but there's the older son who's sort of not really involved
and
in the family.
Prudence,
but
kind of, right?
That's Prudence, right? Yeah. But there's overlap with the Redstones, too, the family that controls CBS and Viacom, where there had been a succession battle for so long. It doesn't quite line up in terms of the structure with the kids, because Sherry Redstone is really sort of the only sort of biological heir apparent. There was an older son, Brent, who basically Sumner bought him out, right? And so he lives in Colorado on a ranch, right?
So that's Connor.
So that is Connor, kind of, right? It's sort of melding. It's a very smart sort of melange of, like,
and
all the
I
big
have,
powerful families.
I know people who spent a lot of time working for the Dolan family, and they see a whole bunch of Dolans in here as well.
Well, maybe before we get into the comparisons, we should just lay out who the characters are on the show.
Emily, hit me. Tell me, who is Logan Roy?
So Logan Roy is the patriarch. He is, like Edmund said, he is basically the Rupert Murdoch. I think he's 85 years old when the series starts, and he has some kind of health episode. Is it a stroke or heart attack or something bad happens to him? And he has four children. The oldest, Connor, you know, from his first marriage, and then the three other ones, two boys and a girl from the second marriage. And the two guys are called Kendall and what's the other one?
Roman.
Kendall and Roman and Shiv. Those are like the three heirs sort of battling for the company, because Logan Roy runs this company, ATN, which is like this massive media company. They have
Royco Waystar.
Well,
ATN
that's the thing,
is the TV.
The
network.
TV, but there's it's right, the right. parent Roy- company, Waystar Royco, that
you.
Like it, yeah. it just again, like how they geek out on little details like that. We're like, well, actually, there's this parent company called Waystar Royco,
which is really clearly the function of a merger between Royco, which is Roy's company, which Logan Roy's company, which he founded, which is the media company, and Waystar, which is clearly some kind of telecom thing that wound up
right that he bought decades ago. Right, exactly.
And then of course, one of the great subplots of the first season is they put like the fuck up son Roman in charge of like a satellite launch, which is clearly part of the Waystar.
There was definitely sort of an Armando Iannucci flavor to that scene. Like, so the show, I'm gonna bring this in. Like, Jesse Armstrong, the showrunner, he had worked with Armando on The Thick of It, In the Loop, which are these BBC or British series that are sort of these really clever satirical takes on power and government and how things.
And of course, Armando did Veep.
and he did Veep, for which Jesse was a writer. He had written one or two episodes.
And I have to say, like, if we're talking about the first episode here, there are definitely times, like, when Kendall, you know, turns around to his cousin Greg and goes, if my septum falls out, I'm going to make you eat my septum, which is just pure Veep.
This is right. And this is, you're talking about last night's episode, right?
Yeah.
The first episode of the second season, there's a lot of great one-liners in there. You can't, I mean, I have a whole list here in front of me, so you know. That is definitely one of them.
So before we get to the last night's episode, we should say at the end of last season, basically the son Kendall Roy, he tries to take over his father's company and then gets himself into this Chappaquiddick scenario where he basically gets this young waiter killed in a car accident, and his whole project of taking over his father's company goes completely sideways, and he winds up weeping. His father basically gets him out of trouble, and that's kind of where we leave off, with Kendall Roy going from about to become, you know, the man who took down his father to just this like broken, you know, just mess of a human being.
The other thing which happened is all of this takes place at his sister's wedding.
Yes. The worst, best wedding ever.
It ended up being a great sort of finale that way, where like this brutal kind of leveraging that the dad does on his son, which is sort of like, wow, that's just so cold. You know, taking advantage of this accident, basically, to like get over on his son who's been trying to take over the company. And that bleeds into the first episode. We see the fallout from that.
And so we open this season with Kendall, who is trying to break his drug habit in an Icelandic spa. And I honestly say, like, this is not just my favorite line of the episode. I have not seen the whole series yet, but like, I think it's going to be my whole favorite line of the whole series. I love this so much, which is when Kendall gets pulled out of his spa and is told to go on the television to try and fight this takeover bid that he instigated, and he looks kind of blankly at this Icelandic apparatchik and he says, I meant to have a silica mud treatment.
Yes.
I've only been here like 48 hours and I'm meant to have a silica mud treatment. Can I just no, I'm sorry, it's not going to work.
The fact that you picked up on that it was Iceland, I mean, what's great is that it doesn't say they're in Iceland. You don't know it. Only if you had ever been there would you know that this is Iceland. Just the bleakness of it and the specific sort of setup of like being in that sauna in the middle of like this blank field, right? Which is exactly how they do it over there.
And also, I mean, just to your point, Ed, about like the little things on this being super researched, silicon mud treatment, I actually looked it up.
Of course you did.
It only exists in like the Blue Lagoon in Iceland. Blue Lagoon silica is a white mud known for strengthening the skin barrier, skin renewal, and deep cleansing.
So I have actually been to the Blue Lagoon, and I have actually put this silica on my body, and it's great. It's brilliant. So I would totally, I get why he wants it. I get why Kendall is like, I'm meant to have that, right? Can I still have that, please? He's so broken in this, really the first few episodes. I don't want to spoil anything going forward, but that sort of reckoning that happened at the finale really plays into the start of the season. And it works. It works really well, I think. It's a really smart use where he's kind of on the sidelines, but still a factor.
There are so many lines where other people are describing Kendall as just utterly broken. Shiv calls him, his sister, a sweaty corpse. Tom Wamsgams, her new husband, says he looks waxy like an unshaven candle, which is one of my favorite lines. At another point, he's called a dead man walking. His dad calls him Mr. Potato Head and my plastic adversary. Like, he's just completely broken down. Like, the sight of him dripping water, being pulled out of that, what is it, Felix? Some kind of hot spring or something?
Yeah.
Just dripping water in his white robe. He's just like, it's like he's not even a person anymore.
He's a wet rat. And this is in stark contrast to season one, episode one, which opens with him psyching himself up in the back of a car by listening to the Beastie Boys. As he's going in to try and like do some deal with some hotshot tech company.
Right.
And
he's the man.
He's like, you know, he's pumping himself up. And he's also clean at that point. And, you know, he's very proud of having, you know, conquered his drug addiction demons, but of course they come back.
I mean, my issue with that character, the way he sort of played out, at least in the first season, is that it was so stark, where he was so the man, all of a sudden, like, oh, what? I don't know what's happening next. And then, you know, my wife and I'm back on drugs and, you know, everything's falling apart. I just wish there were moments where he tried to fight back a little bit more and it didn't quite happen. At least in this first episode of the second season, you totally get why he's broken, right? You could see why he's just hollowed out. And it's kind of interesting that way. It's just really kind of, wow, like this guy, this is what a dead man walking really looks like.
So the first mm-hmm. season did this really quite clever thing where they set it up in the opening episode of, like, Logan Roy has this stroke, the name of the show is Succession, which of his kids is going to take over from him. And then weirdly, you know, that entire plot line gets resolved in about episode 4 of season 1. And then it starts getting interesting. And that was one of the things I loved about season 1, was that the thing that you thought would be the big driving plot line for the whole season is, you know, like the internecine fighting between the kids did not actually become that driving plot line. In this season, again, what we wind up with is this kind of, what's that wonderful Hitchcockian word for?
MacGuffin.
It's a MacGuffin. That you get this wonderful MacGuffin introduced at the very beginning where Logan Roy is like, if I'm going to fight back, I'm going to have to name a successor. I'm like, why? Like, no one ever explains why he needs to name a successor in order to fight back. But I have a feeling this is also going to be one of those things that gets resolved by about season.
I think there's more this idea that you want the season needs to propel, right? So I think the idea of Logan Roy sort of dangling Succession throughout the season, I think, is sort of a key driving force for, like, all the drama that takes place. I would say in this last night's episode, what was really, really smartly done was that whole setup around, like, well, look, are you going to sell? Like, the tech companies are coming after you. Like, it really captures what's been happening with, in the real world, what happened with Rupert Murdoch's company, 21st Century Fox, where he sold to Disney, with all these other mergers that are happening. It's because of big tech coming in and kind of stealing your thunder.
Okay, so, Ed, this is why we invited you on the show, because right? You actually understand this stuff and you can explain it. There is this another line in the show where it's like, tech has its hands round your throat, says the banker to the patriarch. So can you explain what that means? And why is tech like an existential risk to media companies?
So I think that scene that you're talking about really, really vividly captures the state of play, which is, you're a big media company. That means you own movie studios and cable networks and maybe some broadcast networks, maybe some newspapers. We know what's happened in newspapers, right? No one's reading print. That's dying. TV, people are still watching, but not the way they used to. So there are fewer people paying a cable bill now, right? That cuts into 21st Century Fox and Disney to some degree and a bunch of these other media guys. Why is that happening? Because everyone's on Facebook and Instagram and TikTok and doing that thing. So in terms of entertainment, where your distractions are, cable is losing, movie theaters are losing, despite a few sort of outliers like Marvel. And that whole media infrastructure is just dying. It's dying a slow death. That's what makes it sort of frustrating, right? It's not a clear break. It's just every quarter, there's just fewer people paying for television, fewer people going to movie theaters. And guys like Rupert Murdoch are like, what the hell? Right. So him selling out, as surprising as it was for a lot of Murdoch watchers, just from a rational perspective, it, like, made complete sense.
And that was actually almost directly referenced in this episode when Logan Roy gets his family around the table and says, like, we can sell their, you know, his great adversary, this guy Sandy, like, he's overpaying for Royco Waster. We will get $10 billion if we sell right now. And that's clearly setting up at some point.
Well, what's great about
to go to zero.
That's a great detail. $10 billion. Guess what? What did the Murdoch family get out of that Disney sale? They got $12 billion, right? So it was sort of like this perfect, like, if you really want to read deeply into it, like, yeah, that's exactly that situation. Here's the thing, though, as we saw at the end of episode one, what was the resolution? Like, screw it, we're going to stick with this. So it departs from reality in that really specific moment,
because
where he goes,
honestly, if he just decides to sell at the end of episode one, there is
done.
No season.
Yeah, we're over, right? Like, this. Right. So it's a clear departure from what's happened in real life, but it's done in a smart way where they acknowledge what's going on in the world, right? That's what's so smartly done about that.
God, it looks terrible. It's like a sweaty corpse.
Yeah. It looks waxy. Like an unshaven candle.
You know, the long and the short of it is, I saw their plan. and my dad's plan was better.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So before we get to the end, we should say where Kendall went. We should talk about his TV appearance briefly, if not to just mention his talking point, which comes up several times over the course of the episode.
Oh my God, it's so awesome. He gets past a little like 4x6 card in the back of his car in Iceland. And what does the card say, Emily?
I saw their plan and my dad's plan was better.
Which is, he repeats that like to everybody, like he's this automaton, right? Like to his,
everyone
to his family.
Everyone wants to know, why did you back out? He can't say the truth, which is like, oh, I accidentally did a murder and you know, it wouldn't be a good idea for me. And my dad covered it up for me. So I can't
so now
do
I owe him everything.
Anymore.
I'm like, yeah, I'm basically his bitch. And so there, I can't do anything. So that's why.
He can't say any of that. So he just says, I saw their plan and my dad's plan was better. I think he says it at least three times. He says it on TV. And that woman, who is she? The PR
woman?
She's
a communications person. She heads up. Yeah, she's sort of like this very ancillary character, but just present enough that like, it's this believable structure of like a this big, you know, corporate behemoth that has all these different factotums going around. So
yes,
she's that.
And there are all these people around that sort of know more and that are just smarter, obviously, than any of the Roys that sort of know are competent, actually, you know, that layer beneath them.
Right.
There's the Colin, the body man, who basically helps cover up Kendall's crime. You know,
these CEOs, guys like Murdoch, have body men. They've got like these like sort of people who work for them, security for like years and years and years. I'm not saying they're doing cover-ups like that. I'm just saying like they're
you're
that
not,
close.
Not saying that.
I'm not saying that either, but that's an essential part of like this whole, the mythos around these families and how they operate.
Yeah, and I want to get into that too, because the way Logan Roy talks to his son Kendall about the like little murder thing he did, it just really seems like he has so much empathy for him. And I know that's strategic, but I also wonder like, has he killed anyone maybe?
This is my question for you, Emily. In season one, famously to me, I'm not sure how many other people picked up on this, Logan Roy goes swimming in a pool and you see that there's a whole bunch of like scars on his back.
Ooh.
And I was like, wow. And that's clearly going to, you know,
it's going to mean something later.
It's going to mean something at some point. The first thing I thought of when I saw those scars on Logan Roy's back was actually Sumner Redstone hanging off
the ledge of the hotel
in Boston.
Sumner famously survived this hotel fire where he was, you know, gripping, like, and he was already an elderly man. He was in his 60s and there's a hotel fire. He went to the window, he opened it up and he sort of hung off the ledge of the window for like a long time, apparently, until the fire trucks came and rescued him.
Suffered dreadful burns. He was in the hotel room with his mistress, which just makes it even better.
Ooh. Right. And his hand had turned into a claw. Like there was some part of his hand he can't really use ever for, you know, after that moment. But
yeah, Logan Roy definitely has a moment like that or more in his background that I'm hoping that at some point we get more of a taste of, because there is that one scene where he tells his son, it's natural that you're going to think about what happened, but you just can't think about it. You can't think about it very much. Like, you got to put that to the side. And it's clear Kendall really can't do that. And he's just going to take the drugs.
And it sounds like the dad is speaking from some kind of experience, right? Like,
yes,
like,
absolutely.
I've been there, son. Yeah.
Yes.
You know what this is.
Yes. It's all very dark.
I need to geek out just a little bit about this episode on the very, very small little stock price subplot, because in season one, there was a whole bunch of people worrying about the share price and worrying that it was going to go too low. And if it went below a certain level, then that would cause a whole bunch of chaos to the capital stack and the balance sheet and blah, 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 blah. And the loans that
I have some
Logan
issues with that, by the
took
way.
Out against his stock and all of this stuff. And so people were worried about the share price being too low. you come in season two, episode one, and everyone is worried about the stock price for the opposite reason. They're worried that it's too high. And Logan actually goes up to Kendall, his son, and gives him an instruction to, quote, pour a bucket of cold shit on the bid.
That's on my list. Pour me some buckets of cold shit on the bid, all right?
And, like, the idea is people judge the success of Kendall's television appearance based on if he was successful, then the share price would have gone down. And they're like, well, it went down for a minute, and then it went back up again, and so he wasn't successful. And the point, of course, is that the bid that he's fighting off is at a high price. And so if the share price goes up towards the bid price, that means people think that the bid is going to happen.
Right.
If the share price falls down below the bid price, that means they think that Logan Roy is going to win. So we're in this weird sort of bizarro world where everyone in the company wants the share price to be low.
What's great also is they never explain it. They never get into, like, here's why. Like, you know, mostly there's all this exposition when you see some kind of a movie or a TV show. This is just like, no, we're not going to explain it. All you have to do is read the emotions on their faces that, like, yeah, this sucked, right? So, like, but that's a great geeky moment. And I think, you know, for listeners who care about that stuff, you know, that sort of risk arbitrage, right? Whenever a deal is announced or a deal is in play between two companies, you know, there are investors who make bets. They're like, you know, I think this deal is going to happen or it's not going to happen. And the price goes up or down accordingly. That's another great one. I think this second season really, really crackles with, like, business sophistication. It does a really, really good job. Harkening back to the first season that you mentioned, I did have an issue with that whole the MacGuffin in the first season, which was like, oh my God, like, he's in the hospital and, like, you need to take over. I have to tell you something. There's a debt situation that no one knows about. I'm like, what the hell? Here's the thing, though, is that historically, that kind of stuff does happen. There was an example with the National Amusement, Sumner Redstone's parent company, right, that owned CBS and Viacom, where he took out loans. The parent company took out loans against the price of CBS and Viacom, and he kind of hit it. And so when investors found out, they're like, what the fuck? And so he's like, no, it'll be fine. Don't worry. So that scenario has happened. The thing that didn't quite ring true from the fictionalized version is that somehow the debt exists on the public company's books. We're getting really geeky here. That would never happen. You would never happen in real life like that. If anything, it would have been better if, like, the debt holders actually owned the shares or are holding on to them, and, like, they had a covenant to sell at a certain price, which if they did, like, the family would start to lose control.
Although there was a great phone call in the first season where, like, they're on the phone, where Kendall's, is it Kendall? I think it's Kendall.
He's trying to negotiate,
banker,
yeah.
And the banker's like, fuck off.
Yeah.
I have your nuts in a vice. I can do whatever you want. You can't talk yourself out of this. And Ken, this is, like, a running theme, I think, in the whole show, is Kendall, like, really wants to be tough, and he can act tough, but, like, no one takes him seriously.
The setup is also sort of like, as much as you might sort of despise the dad for whatever reason, shareholders believe in him. You know, that's what they're buying into, the him as much as the fundamentals of the company. And, like, when there's a moment where Ken takes over, there's this sort of, I don't know, who is this kid? Do I trust him? Is he going to be a good leader? And I think that sort of reverberates through the whole season, which is, like, are the kids good enough, not just in the eyes of the dad, but, like, in the eyes of the world?
I mean, the kids are terrible. I think the next scene that we need to talk about is the set piece of this episode.
Yeah, so this is an Armando Iannucci DNA show, which yes. means that every single character is terrible. So, like, that just kind of goes without saying. But yeah, if you're talking about what I think you're talking about, Emily, the best scene I think that Succession has ever done is the scene between Logan and Siobhan in the summer house in the Hamptons.
This is the moment.
Let's talk about how we get to that moment. So they all go out to the Hamptons, to the summer palace, or the shit pit, as I think Roman calls it. And when they get there, you know, it's just this, like, what's great about Succession is, you know, it's like this kind of, it's wealth porn, but it's all kind of twisted and ugly looking. So, you know, you have this, like, beautiful, I think at one point Logan says it's like a $200 million house or something. And it's really beautiful. And you see everyone, like, unloading these gigantic steaks and these lobsters. And then everyone who walks into the mansion is like, ugh, what's that smell? Right. And then the smell turns out to be literally a bag of raccoons stuffed
Wait, can I mention, like, chimney? Another great line from the episode where Logan walks in to the house and he says, it smells like the cheesemonger died and left his dick in the brie.
Yes, that was on my list, Felix. It's the bag of raccoons. There's a bag of raccoons stuffed up the chimney. So, and that kind of hangs over
it's
everything.
Moment,
and then
yeah.
When they finally find the raccoons, Logan then makes them throw out all the beautiful food because it sat in the stink. And then there's this shot where Kendall is smoking outside, and then behind him are all these, you know, waitstaff throwing out lobster, steak, shrimp. It's just like disgusting.
And they're getting pizza. They're getting pizza because he's like, fuck this shit. I just want pizza.
And then Siobhan is
and no one eats anything.
As Siobhan and Roman start walking into the dining room and they're talking about what's going to happen. And Siobhan's like, oh, maybe we kill and eat Kendall as a pizza topping.
That was great.
Yeah, but no one eats even a bite of the food, which I thought was hilarious. Like, there's all this attention and money spent on all this food. It gets thrown away. They replace it with more stuff. No one eats any of it because no one actually cares about what money can buy. They're just doing power plays with each other and nothing else even matters. Like, all this wealth is for nothing.
They're afraid to eat and they're afraid to talk, right? That's the whole point of that. Right. He gathers them around. He's like, what do you think I should do? Should I sell? Because he's responding to his banker sort of urging him, look, you should just sell. Like, the smart play is to sell. And it's a serious, it's not just some kind of political moment. It's like an actual, here's what's happening in the real world.
If you don't sell now, then your company is going to be worth much less in 4 or 5 years' time. So the smart move is to sell now.
Exactly. And so he's earnestly asking the kids and the few executives in the room, what should I do? And no one wants to tell them what they really think because they're all afraid of him, right? Because there's this line for a moment where he's like, I like money and I'm afraid of you. Like, this is all he said. And I'm like, that's it. That's exactly everything. That's the whole show. And so then we get to the point where he has this sort of one-on-one with the kids, right? To see like where we're getting to this moment now. Like, well, fine. If we're going to stick with it, how do we do that, right? And so succession is a part of that question.
And so, yeah, and so, like, he decides, first of all, he brings in Roman, who acts, you know, in classic Roman fashion, like, talking about a bunch of words, which he doesn't really know what they mean, but, like, you know, sounding vaguely, desperately trying to sound like he has a clue what business his dad is in. Roman leaves. In comes Siobhan, and there's this unbelievable sort of game of cat and mouse between Logan and Siobhan, where Logan basically calls her bluff by threatening to tweet. And this is the other thing which I love about this episode is this season even, is I think they're going to start making tiny little nods at the Trump parallels.
Oh, yes, it was a very Trumpy episode. There's a scene where Logan Roy kind of, he stiffs the contractor. That is out of Donald Trump's playbook 100%, where he says, I'm only going to pay you $100,000, but he owes
absolutely
more than twice that much.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he says, just sue me. My lawyers work for the Justice Department. That was completely
Who do your
Trumpian.
Lawyers work for? Right.
Yes.
And the tweet thing is both a reference to Trump and also Elon Musk, right? Who, like,
yes.
Like, he's famous for, you know, he basically got himself in a hot water. Like, he actually had to, you know, pay a fine for tweeting things that weren't quite true.
So Siobhan basically says, yeah, sell. You know, honestly, just do it. Just sell. And he's like, okay. And he's like, if you don't want to take over, I'm going to sell. And then
you could see this moment where she's just like, no, don't do it. It's this great, great emotional moment where you could see it in her eyes where she's like, man, shit, I want this.
I do what I want. And what I've decided I'd like to do is to formally ask you to come in and be the next chief executive of this company.
I don't think I'm the right person.
Well, you know, I'm pretty smart, and I think you are. You are, Shiv. You're the one.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Sarah Snook is the actor who plays Siobhan.
Aussie. She's an Aussie.
She's amazing. I think she's the arguably the best actor on the show. She's so good.
She's the most compelling character for sure because she's both awful but human, right?
Right.
And is sort of the one you relate to the most in the sense that, like, oh, you kind of, you get where she's coming from and she seems more or less down to earth.
With the only exception of the one question which everyone has about Siobhan, it's like, why did she marry that guy?
she's the only sibling that appears to be intelligent and knows what she's doing and competent at all. So when he says she's the natural successor, it's actually pretty believable. You're like, of course she is. Who else could it literally be?
She's also the only sibling who has ever had a job for anyone other than Logan Roy.
So
yes, exactly.
Talking about real world sort of muses or examples, I mean, Elizabeth Murdoch, who is the daughter of Rupert Murdoch, for years and years and years, media observers were always sort of playing this guessing game, like who's gonna win that one? And she was always sort of put forth as she's the one most like her dad in that the smartest, the most capable, also did not work for her dad for the longest time, also worked at, you know, sort of in politics and sort of on a PR level.
Well, she was famously married to Matthew Freud, who was like
PR guy,
the king of PR in the UK.
So he's...
Wasn't he like dopey like the way Tom Wamsgams is dopey? Is that an over...
No. Matthew Freud is not dopey.
He's definitely a power player. Like he's not... Okay. You know, I think it's just sort of this sort of funny character. I think the guy who plays him is so brilliant. It's just so...
Matthew McFadden.
Oh my God. It's just... He's so like... awful in this kind of obsequious way that you're just like,
So Tom is definitely a character out of Veep. He's one of those like caricature characters who's great for comic relief and for bringing a bunch of just sheer entertainment value into the show. And like, he's the guy
he's wonderfully craven,
swallowing his own semen. But yeah, the way they get him into the show is by getting him to marry Siobhan, and that bit just doesn't really ring true.
It doesn't, but it's also kind of like he's such a known quantity to her that she knows she can control and that they have this open marriage and everything. I think it feels like, you know, it's more of a control move than it is I love this man kind of a thing. So
yeah, I think she wants someone she can actually have power over. Like she's so clearly in the pole position and he doesn't mind.
But well, he does mind. I mean, this
he genuinely
thinks that he is in line to become CEO. Right. Like, somewhere in that, like, mush of a brain of his is, like, this tiny little glimmer of ambition saying, I want to be the CEO of Roystar Waco. And, like, anyone with the slightest glimmer of self-awareness would know that was, like, zero possibility. But he's so delusional.
So delusional, but also because Siobhan herself sort of, you know, she's playing up to him, too, a little bit. She has throughout the whole first season, and you can see it in the season one, up until that moment, that scene with her and her dad, where she's, like, on the verge of tears, like, wait a minute, I think I want it. But she doesn't want to want it. That's the thing. You can see it in her face. It's like, why do I want this kind of a thing?
Can I also mention my other favorite little grace note about this episode and about Tom in particular? When the episode begins, Tom and Siobhan are on their honeymoon on their like 250-foot yacht in some like glamorous location or something. And the only people we ever see on this yacht is Siobhan and Tom.
In the beginning, the first scene, the curtains are drawn. They're like on this boat, this beautiful view of the sea, and they have the curtains drawn, and they're like trying to
watch Kendall on the iPad. And she's like, we've got very bad Wi-Fi because we literally, we tried to go somewhere with bad Wi-Fi. But the thing which struck me about that scene is that Tom, on his honeymoon, on a yacht, in the middle of nowhere, which doesn't even have Wi-Fi, is wearing an absolutely immaculate seersucker suit.
Yes.
You know something about seersucker, right? Come on. I know, Felix. You have a whole, rack of seersucker suits.
And you're like, come on. Like, you know, seersucker suits are what you wear, like, in cities in the summer, not on a yacht. They're not yachting wear, for Christ's sake, Tom.
But he's from, like, Ohio, like, middle class, like, Tom, who, like, you know, is this how you do it? You know, he's this, this outrageous Aravis type who's just like, this is, you know, this is the role we play, right?
Right. Kind of a thing. Exactly. So Siobhan, finally allows herself to admit that she really wants to be the CEO. She accepts Logan's offer. She's like, is this real? She asks him, is this real? Like 18 times. Mm-hmm. He's like, this is real. He's like, remember the slant of the light. This is the moment. And that's like the emotional heart of the episode. And it's just an absolutely beautifully shot and directed and acted scene. I love that scene.
I think that scene really makes it and makes you want more. And I think you kind of get the sense that like, you don't even believe it fully. You're just like, he's going to dangle this. He's going to do this. He's going to puppet master.
She comes out and the first thing she says to her husband, oh, it's like Logan Roy mind games. Like even she on some level doesn't really believe it.
Right, exactly. But that was the one.
I mean, do you guys believe it? I don't believe it.
I don't believe it either. If anything, it's like, also, come on, we need more show, right? There has to be this possibility of he fucks over the kids. He does the whole thing.
Right. But on some level, if you're Logan Roy, you know that the sensible thing to do is to sell, but you're Logan Roy, so you can't sell. And also you have an entire season to fill, so you can't sell. He is smart. Like, he is in full possession of all of his faculties at the beginning of this season. There's none of this whole, like, he's a, you know, vegetable kind of, like, having a stroke stuff. He is very smart. He's in control of everything. And he knows that Siobhan is, of all of his children, the only one who can credibly take over the company.
And she's believable that way, too, because the way she talks about the business, you're like, wow, she really knows what she's talking about. She has, and in fact, that in that moment, in that scene where he asks her, what would you do? And she lays it all out. I'm like, that's exactly right. You know, it's almost like, you know, if you were in that real business, those are the steps you would take.
And the big difference between what she wants to do and what Roman wants to do is that she wants to get rid of the news operation. She says it's a distraction, it's noise, it's a pain in the ass, and like let's just kill news, go big on like theme parks and blockbusters, kill like indie films and everything that isn't massive.
That's exactly right. Makes right now, sense. That's what
Roman, meanwhile, when he comes in, he's like, we double down on news because that's where all of our political power comes from. And it's an interesting difference between them two. Like, I feel like Logan ultimately is always going to want to be an important player. And therefore, he's going to want to keep the news operation. This, of course, is a direct...
That's Murdoch. That is very Murdoch.
Murdoch talks to Trump every day on the phone. And the reason he talks to Trump every day on the phone is not because he's a media billionaire. It's because he owns Fox News.
Right. And so I think that's the one thing. What's interesting is that Murdoch, you know, since we're using him as a primer for a lot of this, if you look closely, he's actually very unsentimental. He's a very, very sort of rigorous business mind. The only time he becomes sentimental is when it comes to news. He can't not own that. So that's the one thing that, like, he'll pay for. He'll just own it and eat it because...
He'll pay $5 billion for the Wall Street Journal.
And then write off half of it the year later, or he'll continue to fund the New York Post at a $40 million annual loss just because he needs to have it, right?
Right. So.
It's not clear how far that parallel is going to go. Like, that difference, sell news or keep news, it's not clear to me which side Logan will be on.
But before he gets anywhere near that, he needs to, first of all, have this big fight with Sandy
Furness. So I'm curious what you guys think.
So who's Sandy?
I have an idea who Sandy Furness is.
Who's Sandy?
Sandy Furness is John Malone.
Oh my God, I was totally going to say that.
Yes, he's John Malone. So for listeners who may not know or care, but you should care, John Malone basically invented the cable industry in the United States and is probably the most feared media executive on the planet. Al Gore once referred to him as Darth Vader. Like, that's how. And there is a historical truth around this, where there's a moment around early 2000s where he was quietly buying up shares of News Corp, Rupert Murdoch's company, to the point where he actually threatened Murdoch's ownership stake over, controlling stake over the business. And Murdoch didn't know this was happening until it was too late. What Malone was trying to do, and there's a phrase in the first episode that you might have heard, asset swap, right? That's sort of an interesting...
And the asset swap is exactly what Murdoch and Malone did.
Where basically Malone said, you know what? I'll sell you your shares back, but I want DirecTV, which Murdoch had a significant stake in. Murdoch was trying to turn, you know, he owned, or once upon a time owned, Sky in the UK, which is a satellite TV service there. He tried to replicate that idea in the US through DirecTV. Took a little bit longer. Malone spoiled his plans, and they did this great asset swap where basically Malone got control of DirecTV and then Murdoch was able to buy his shares back. And afterwards, like, Murdoch learned his lesson. Like, he put in a poison pill in the company charter where you couldn't do that anymore.
No, but there are these, like, grand figures of darkness like John Malone, to a certain extent, maybe Charlie Ergen as well.
And yeah, he's everyone is sort of like a mixture of characters, but I think right. The closest for Sandy Furness is John Malone. And then the way that that first episode ends, where, you know, where Kendall comes in to deliver the message, this is one of I have a whole list of these. One of my favorite lines. It comes at the very end where he's just delivering this message, but he does it in a way that's sort of properly done. You know, he aims to kill you. He's talking about Logan to Sandy. He said, he will go bankrupt or go to jail before he lets you beat him. He will send men to kill your pets and fuck your wives, and it will never be over. Yeah. So that's the message. Right? And you're just like, and Sandy Furness goes, let's get on with that process then.
Right? Yes. Like,
yes.
And that's how it should ends. Work.
Right? Yeah.
So well done.
It's a great final line.
Yeah, it really is. I think I really give the writers credit because I think, especially in this first episode, there's so many great details, like financial, the arcana of like how financial deals work and boardroom procedures that like they really nailed it. But they also depart far enough from reality that like it's this escape, that it's this fun thing that like, yes, you would like it to happen that way kind of a thing.
And he wanted me to tell you to say, yeah, obviously our public line will be that we are considering the offer, but it doesn't matter what you offer. He'll never recommend this to the board. You're going to bleed cash. He's going to bleed cash. It will never end. And maybe you'll kill him. But if you don't, he aims to kill you. He will go bankrupt or go to jail before he lets you beat him. He will kill you on the business. And if that doesn't work, he will send people around. He will send men to kill your pets and fuck your wives. And it will never be over. So that's the message.
Good. Well, let's move ahead with that process, shall we?
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So that was episode one.
Yeah. Well done.
We have 9 more to go. This is going to be a roller coaster, I'm absolutely sure. Let's just end this with our one favorite line from the whole show. Emily, what was your one favorite line from the whole show?
Oh, this is so hard. I have so many written down. I'm going to go with Greg, cousin Greg, who we didn't really talk about very much, but he's in Kendall's apartment. He's looking around, and to Greg's eyes, this is an amazing, amazing apartment, to my eyes as well. And then he compliments it, and Kendall's like, yeah, I couldn't get anything better. It's fashion week. All the good penthouses are taken, but the line I really liked.
Yeah, there are good Greg penthouses saying, and there are shit penthouses. Yeah.
Yeah. He said, oh yeah, it could be way better. I just don't know how. Which to me says everything about these rich
people. Great,
they don't see it. Yeah.
If I need to come up with a line we haven't mentioned, I'll say when Kendall goes into the meeting with Sandy and then says that his dad isn't coming in because he has to take
a call. Oh, I know what you're going
to
say.
And this great line, he had to take a call. That's like a 1987 power move.
Dude.
Stewie.
That was on my
Stewie
list, too.
Great lines.
That was on my list.
1987. And it's so true. And it is true. Like, we, at the end of season one, there's this scene where Logan is like keeping the president of the United States on hold. And it's just like, he does have this 1987 power move thing, which he can't quite become part of the 21st century.
But that's exactly what Trump does, too. You know, he like still plays that old power book, but that's exactly. I'm going to follow that up. My favorite line, if I had to pick one, there's so many. But it's in that same scene where, again, there's this great human moment where this is the guy, the private equity guy who is friends with Kendall, who, like, when they first set this up, the guy who's standing in front of the Sandy Furness character.
Stewie.
And he's like, dude, I'm a human being here. If you need a human being, I'm here for you. Just what is going on, right? There's this moment of like, you could talk to me, dude. And, you know, he's like, well, I looked at the plan and my dad's plan is better than your kind of thing. And he goes, fuck you. And he goes, fuck you too, you pulsimanious piece of fool's gold, fucking silver spoon, fucking asshole, right? It's like, that, like, okay, like, that's it. Yeah. There's no.
And personally, I am always going to be a fan of any TV show which uses the word pusillanimous.
Oh,
because
absolutely.
Pusillanimous is one of my favorite words.
Right there in that first episode.
And it's right there in episode one. So thanks for staying with us through the episode one recap. We will be back same time, same channel next week with episode two. And thanks very much for listening to Sleep Money Extra.